Something, something Lebowski. In honor of Hell or High Water, what is the best Jeff Bridges performance?
I'm Matt Patches, and I don't know what the best Jeff Bridges performance is, but I'm going to say Starman, the 1984 John Carpenter film. And mostly I can just imagine Jeff Bridges' beautiful mug standing there ready to walk off into eternity with do-do-do-do-do-do, you know the drill.
I'm Joanna Robinson, and on the musical theme that Patches just started, I'm going to say The Fabulous Baker Boys that features Michelle Pfeiffer and Brother Bo.
I'm Dave with a 7, and just for variety, I'm going to use my nostalgia card here and play the Fisher King. Rest in peace, Robin Williams.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going to go old school, older school than even the Fisher King, and go with The Last Picture Show, because without The Last Picture Show, we have none of the subsequent Jeff Bridges picture shows.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fighting in the War Room. This is episode 131 for Tuesday, August 9th, 2016. Wow. Today in 1930... Betty Boop debuted in the Fleischer Studios cartoon Dizzy Dishes, Boop Boopy Doop. That's a little film history for you. And now...
Cartoon history. Cartoon my favorite history. Type of history.
I'm making,
no one gets hurt.
I'm making Patches dryly saying Boop Boopy Doop my text tone now.
Boop Boopy Doop. Boop Boopy Doop. And speaking of Boop Boopy Doop, which is the sound I think people make when they're typing reviews into iTunes, reviews from iTunes. David?
Okay, well, thank you, as ever, listeners. We have a wonderful selection, a banquet, if you will, of reviews this week. And as per tradition, and out of respect for you all out there listening and writing into us, I will now read them all as fast as I can. The first, from J1MB031, says, "Everyone is great. David, Katie, Patches, Dave Seven, and Joanna, not Jordan Hoffman." Thank you, J1MB031. Also, we have Frederick1308, who says, Whenever anyone asks me for a film podcast recommendation, I give them Fighting in the War Room. This show features a brilliant group of very smart, very different critics who discuss culture news and review movies. The only downside of recommending it is I have to explain the numerous spin-off podcasts that show up in the same feed. I love all these critics, but Katie and recurring guest Joanne are the people I agree with most consistently. That being said, they've all been my favorite at one point in the 4 years I've been a listener, even David. That time, he loved the Pitch Perfect and Magic Mike sequels. Anyone else out there? You alive?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, all we're right. Here. We also loved Pitch Perfect.
Wait, was I supposed to chime in then?
No, I just was getting... It was so quiet, I was getting concerned that I've been cut off. We also have It's Great to Be Fine from the 7th Sean. Fighting in the War Room is simply fantastic. Whenever a new episode shows up in my feed, I immediately ditch whatever else I was listening to, looking at you, Billions podcast, and dive right into Dave Seven, Katie Patches, and David's discussion. As a longtime listener, I've observed a few certainties, or at least things to expect when listening to an episode of Fighting in the War Room. One, Katie will steer the ship unless she's on maternity leave. She'll keep the conversation moving, all while being insightful and optimistic about whatever piece of pop culture is being discussed. Two, David will have feelings, hard. His opinions might frustrate you, but he's smarter and more accurate than you. Huh. So if you're frustrated, don't be angry with him. It's not his fault.
That did not say accurate. That said
Dave
articulate.
Dave Seven will seem completely caught off guard when asked to contribute. But he's always got a deep, oftentimes structural, multi-layered take on a given subject. He's like the tiramisu of podcast hosts if tiramisu hated the movie Brave. Four, Patches will mispronounce every single surname. Seriously, every single one. He'll also be the host most likely to completely embrace the movie's unabashed weirdness, and it'll make you want to check things out that you might otherwise not have wanted to. Five, Joanna is the Stephen Tobolowsky of podcasting, which is to say that you're always delighted when she shows up, and you have absolutely no idea how she has any time to be there, because she's got about 50 podcast hosting gigs going simultaneously. Side note, sorry I couldn't come up with a female equivalent to Stephen Tobolowsky. I tried, but gender aside, I think the comparison is spot on. Asterisk. Other side note, do not Google female Stephen Tobolowsky. Joking aside, Fighting in the War Room is truly an excellent bit of pop culture analysis, and it's something I truly look forward to every week. Thanks for the excellent show, and keep up the great work.
What's wrong with Millen, Googling female Stephen Tobolowsky?
Shut your hole. We're on a roll here. A. Millen says, be as political as you want. I wanted to put in my two cents on the argument you had on a recent show. I love politics. Almost every other podcast I listen to is politics, and they run into the dozens. And I appreciate you talking about it when it comes up, and I agree with David that, like all other things that make up movies, its political, moral, or undertones deserve to be discussed. Anyway, I love you all. You each bring your own biases and experience to the podcast, which makes the discussions all the better. We have more reviews, but I've been advised by my overlords that this is taking too long. And so to those of you who have left reviews in the past week that have not yet been read, I promise you we will get to your reviews in next week's episode or in one of the upcoming ones after that. In the order in which they were received, thank you for listening. Please keep sending in your reviews. I'll read them out breathlessly on the air.
I really, really don't get what's wrong with Googling female Stephen Tobolowsky. You just get a lot of entries for single white female and him kind of hugging.
Listen, don't. The readers, the hugging listener women. Is always right.
I also want to apologize to you because I've said a few things about you over the years that are, you know, in polite company, perhaps are unforgivable.
Almost
unforgivable.
And some nice things.
I don't remember saying anything nice. But anyway, I hope you'll accept my apology.
Accept
and
it.
I just want to give you the opportunity. Is there anybody you'd like to apologize to right now yourself?
So for our first segment this evening, I am going to pass the baton to Matt and Joanna for the most part, but I guess I can get the ball rolling. It's about Stephen Colbert, the host of The Colbert Report. Nope, that's not true. He is Stephen Colbert, the host of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert on CBS, which is the channel that my television defaults to, and then I immediately change as though it were infectious.
High praise.
Although I hear Brain Dead is a good show.
You hear wrong.
That's too bad. Stephen Colbert has had an interesting transition to being the host of The Late Show, taking on that prestigious role in the late night landscape, moving over from the Colbert Report, where he was doing more pointed satire and that sort of fit with his background, which sometimes people think of as being at the Daily Show, but smarter people will tell you truly belongs to Strangers with Candy. And he is now having an iffy time, I'm told, adjusting to having to appeal to a broader swath of viewers than just the people who are interested in his political skewering, appearing to the David Letterman crowd, and I guess since everyone's chasing Fallon, sort of the Jay Leno crowd as well. And recently at the conventions, the Republican convention in particular, he fiddled a little bit with his format, did a few live shows, got in the mix by appearing in person at the convention, being where he was not supposed to be, and so on. There's been a lot of chatter as to whether or not his show is in trouble. There's talk about they had recently revamped it a little bit, and then recently, and I guess this is going to be the crux of our conversation in just a second, he had Donald Trump on the show, and I only saw this in a little bit of a vacuum, so perhaps my co-host can provide some more context, but it seems as if he did the truly repugnant, irresponsible thing of apologizing to Donald Trump on air. For the comments that he made about him, the jokes that he made about him, which were...
I don't think he apologized on air.
He did. So
he did. I saw it. It was terrible.
So the context is...
But this was also back
that,
when?
Yeah, that
this
wasn't
was
recently.
September.
That was September, like September 23rd. It was like the first week of his show.
His first month of doing the show.
This is why I like to couch my thoughts. You know, it's good, especially in these political climates, to not know what you don't know. Or to know what you don't know, rather.
So he had Trump on, I think it was literally his first week. It might have been his second week, but I think it was somewhere around there.
He started the show on September 8th, and he had Trump on September 23rd.
Okay, so within the first month, he had Trump on. He started the segment by apologizing, which our colleague Mike Ryan, take this with whatever Ryan-sized grain of salt you want to, says was Trump's condition to appearing, that the host had to apologize, and he shopped that around to a couple different shows, and Colbert's producer was the one thirsty enough to bite. And that's because, you know, Colbert, the transition from Comedy Central, I'm sympathetic to a lot of this. The transition from Comedy Central to CBS was not the easiest in the whole world for Colbert. He had a lot of people worried about him leaving behind the satirical bent and going a more straightforward route. And so the Colbert, the Late Show with Stephen Colbert, you know, had some growing pains in the first few months. Now Stephen Colbert has decided to go back to what made him so famous, and even like with some joking aside about how he can't do an exact copy of the Colbert Report, he has brought out some of his old tricks, like the segment that was called The Word, W-O-R-D, on the old Colbert Report is now called The Word, W-E-R-D, on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. He's going full throttle for Trump. I brought up on Twitter last week that as happy as I was to see Colbert doing this, I am not going to forget how soft he was on Trump in that first month.
Wait, when you say full throttle for Trump, you mean
after
as a target?
Yes, going for the jugular. And you know, he's called Trump, I believe, like repugnant or something very harsh. And then he had a cartoon version of Trump on his show, an animated version. And he was like, "This is what I would ask Trump if he were on my show now." Ignoring the fact that he had Trump on live and also as a call-in, and was sort of soft, varying degrees of soft, both those times. And so,
but can he be forgiven for thinking that Trump was less of a threat once back? You know, way back when, and he didn't understand, and none of us did at the time, the full extent of his jingoism, racism, and
I think, xenophobia. Well, this was after Trump had made, like, you know, comments about Mexicans and comments about Muslims. Like, he had already said some of the most repulsive things that, you know, he would go on to say even more repulsive things, but he had already said some truly egregious things. And, you know, there are people like John Oliver, Samantha Bee started later, but, like, there are a few comedians who didn't, like, Colbert's not the only one who went soft. Fallon went soft, Kimmel went soft, like a couple.
Well, and those guys went soft after the fact. So,
but Fallon
I just want to say that Colbert had Trump on at the end of September, and then Fallon had him on in January, and then Kimmel just had him on in like May. So around the time they were talking about a Bernie debate.
But Fallon is the gold standard of rolling over and getting fucked in the
ass. Exactly.
I mean, like, it is truly shameful. And that's his whole brand. I mean, like, I get it. He wants to play games with every celebrity. He passes no judgment. It's a completely safe space. But when
Trump impression.
But I think it's okay for me to hold Colbert to a higher standard. And also to say that Colbert is getting a lot of juice now off of going after Trump. Everyone's like, yay, Colbert's back. This is so great. And I agree. It's great. I agree. I'm glad he's doing this. This is something I believe that he does not support Trump. So I believe he's being honest here. I believe that this is what he's truly very, very brilliant at. I'm so glad he's doing it. But he was part of, and probably because, you know, his show was brand new. They were trying to find their footing. His executive producer at the time has since been fired. But he was part of the machine that helped create Trump in the first place. And there's to spread around. There's a lot of blame to spread around.
Yeah, I'm not overstating the case to really say that the Trump train would have been at all impinged by not appearing on Stephen Colbert that one night.
Well, they all have dirty hands. Everyone who gave him as much air as they gave him has dirty hands, in my opinion.
Yeah, but I think that, like, you know, this whole country is dirty hands. I think that the you want to claim responsibility for Trump or pass blame for him, it goes and goes and goes around until we're all...
I just want Colbert to have his sliver.
That's what's so weird. I mean, I do agree that, like, making a joke out of Trump is what eventually kind of cleared the path for him to rise and get into this position. But I still wouldn't blame it on the comedians, whose job is to lampoon the true jokes of the universe. And Trump was a joke in September when Colbert interviewed him, and he was supposed to, and people were supposed to see him for what he is, or what, I mean, I'm trying to be actually apolitical here, that he, his, kind of sensationalism. I think Colbert believes in the political system, and that's what I got a lot out of the Colbert Report and his time on The Daily Show. He believes in politics. He believes that people on either side of the line can be level-headed, and by having Trump on, all you have to do is let the man speak, and people can kind of see through that. We've learned in the months ahead that, like, even people on his own side are kind of turning their backs to him. And Colbert hoped that you could just sit Trump down and have a laugh, and everyone could get past this moment, and the Republican Party would kind of work itself out, and the true victor would emerge. But no, the joke kept spreading, and it became less and less of a joke, but it doesn't seem like Colbert was in the wrong to make it a joke in the first place.
I think it's also, it's worth focusing on the fact, not just that it was his first week, and so he was desperate for ratings, but also that he was trying to reestablish his brand, and I think that, you know, central to the new Stephen Colbert, the real Stephen Colbert, is this genuine Christian sense of sincerity. And I say that in the nicest, most humane way possible, that he prides himself in being a fundamentally decent person. Those are his values. And I think I am playing devil's advocate a little bit here, but I can definitely rationalize how extending an olive branch to this one, this person who I'm sure even at the time he perceived as a threat, maybe not as great a threat as he is now, letting him, you know, if he was going to put his foot in his mouth, fine. And that could certainly have been part of the motivation. But just having the decency to treat him like a human being and show America unlike his character, that this was going to be a staple of what he's going to do.
I agree with some of what you say about Colbert, but I will say that in the context of that week on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, he had Ted Cruz on earlier in the week. And he pinned Ted Cruz down, repeating questions over and over again about Ronald Reagan and the legacy of the Conservative Party, and just grilled Ted Cruz. And he asked Trump, like, he not only apologized to Donald Trump for ever making fun of him, but he also asked Donald Trump, Barack Obama, born in the United States? And Trump goes, I don't talk about that anymore. And that's it. No follow-up questions. So, like, if one night you're going to grill Ted Cruz and hold his feet over the fire, and then you're just going to give Donald Trump a free pass because...
Yeah, but he's grilling the apparent threat.
The requirement of his appearance was that he get the softball. Like, I'm just saying, Stephen Colbert sold out for this one night of a very, very amazing career. And I'm not saying it tarnishes his entire legacy. He's a great man, truly very brilliant. I'm glad we have him. I just am not going to forget that he did that.
Yeah. So. I do think it's interesting on a broader sense, too, about, like, when are they selling out? When is comedy not doing its job, as if comedy has a job? You know, what
was,
is Colbert
was SNL
there to do?
More egregious
SNL
for
was,
having Trump host?
SNL was definitely egregious, but what I will say is, you know, I got that response a lot when I was talking about this on Twitter. A lot of people were like, well, it's not his job, he's a comedian. But, like, if his brand, especially now, is political comedian, then it is his job. You know, like, it's not, it's his job not to have Trump on and just fan the flames of his bullshittery, and then later, months and months later, you know, pick up steam for tearing him down after helping in a small way, part of a larger machine, helping to build him up.
Well, I think his brand at the time was to, you know, explicitly move away from being a political comedian, even while... using these major political figures in order to do that, to have them on and not have super wonky conversations with them. Would I have loved him to have Trump on and skewer, like, actually crucify him on stage? Absolutely.
Or never have him on in the first place, you know?
And is SNL having him host somehow, for reasons that it's not immediately easy to put my finger on, a lot more disgusting? Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, and, you know, at the end of the day, if Trump's media exposure is what sinks him, which it looks like it will, then it's hard for me, at least, to rake Stephen Colbert across the coals.
I love Stephen Colbert. I'm just never going to forget watching him apologize to Donald Trump on air. Trump, you know, called Mexican rapists. So.
A sickening sight. Dave... Any thoughts? And not just because you just said Mexican.
Great time for me to chime in, as per usual. yeah, I don't know. You're definitely willing to feel any way that you want right now, for sure. But I'm only going to start distributing blame if we elect the idiot. Otherwise, we've given him a platform to say some of the stupidest shit as the head of a major political party. So, I mean, I think ultimately Stephen Colbert, even though he could return to politics to be a comedian, fancies himself a performer first. And you make those, you sing for the king if the king comes calling. And at this pace, Donald Trump was building a candidacy without political spending, but by, appearing on TV shows. So it's all just a way around, Citizens United. I'm still not worried about it. The Trump campaign has not stirred up fear in me. We're
I'll just say that, it used to be that the host of The Daily Show and the host of The Colbert Report were the political comedians that I respected the most. And now I will say that mantle has passed to Samantha Bee.
10 years
and John
ago,
Oliver.
We had Steve Hope, Bob Cash, Johnny Jobs. And now they're all dead. So move on.
Money tax plan. Gordon. Fun times.
All right. And that does it for politics in this week's episode. So everyone out there can breathe easy. We're talking about kids and shit next.
Man, and a man's gotta learn to take it. Try to believe, though the going gets rough, that you're gonna hang tough to make it. History repeats itself, try and you succeed. Never doubt that you're the one, and you can have your dreams. You're the best around.
For our mini segment this evening, I saw a... I'll scratch that. For our mini segment this evening, we are going to be talking a quick rapid-fire round with only inflexible rules, very rigid rules, where everyone is going to get a choice to say the best working filmmaker today. That's it. You got to pick one. On the planet, the best currently working filmmaker. I guess, Godard could technically qualify. If you happen to have, because he's alive, he's working, he's sensible, he's another film that can. If you think that his late, but really, is he still making his best stuff? I don't know. A lot of people feel he is. Some people tell me that he's making his best stuff. I don't know. But this, I will start because this topic bubbled up into my brain earlier today when I was thinking of one filmmaker in particular and how excited I am to see his latest movie. And he's been my go-to answer in recent years, really, in truth, only since the death of Appa Kiarostami, but was always sort of the runner-up, and that is Olivier Assayas, whose Personal Shopper is a film that I cannot wait to see, but I think that he is incapable of making an interesting movie. I think pound for pound, he is the best working filmmaker on the planet. He does not miss. Everything he does is fascinating, and has been for decades now.
What do you think of Carlos? You're a big Carlos fan?
Okay. Love Carlos. I happen to be in the camp that believes that he is firing on all cylinders right now, even more so than he ever was in the past. I mean, Irma Vep is one of my favorite movies. That was in the mid-90s, and that was right on the heels of movies like Cold Water, and when he was really coming up in the world. And all that stuff is great, but I think his more sort of nostalgia-tinged, supple filmmaking he's doing these days, like Something in the Air, Clouds of Sils Maria, Carlos, all this stuff, Summer Hours. These are all nearly perfect movies as far as I'm concerned. So Olivier Assayas is my guess. Fingers crossed. I love Personal Shopper, but I can guarantee you that even if I don't, it will offer plenty of food for thought.
Is that coming out soon, or is that playing more festivals?
It's going to come out, I am told, whispers in the wind telling me that it's going to come out early in 2017. It will take it to the bank, be at the New York Film Festival, which should officially be announced by the time that this podcast goes to air, and may pop up at a few other film festivals this fall as well.
There you go. Joanna.
Boom.
Oh, okay. My answer is P.T. Anderson, and you can disagree with me if you like, but that's my answer.
Who could disagree with you?
Yeah, I was about to say, don't be so self-deprecating here. It's a good
Jeez
choice.
Louise.
As I said off air, I wish that I could have come up with one who was not white and male and straight, but the heart wants what the heart wants, and I think P.T. Anderson is just completely brilliant. I am I don't love Punch Drunk Love, but that's the only one that I don't love. I love the rest, so...
Listen, white straight guys are currently a toxin upon this planet. Let's celebrate at least two of them for not making this hellhole a little bit worse.
Well, I mean, it's like an industry problem that doesn't even allow you to pick women a lot of the times. I mean,
hey,
they're just not being enabled.
One of my, anyone who knows me knows that my Olivia Assayas was neck and neck with Sofia Coppola. So,
I thought you were going to say his wife.
This whole thing started because I saw his wife's latest movie this morning, and it is absolutely wonderful.
Who is his wife for the people listening?
Mia Hansen-Love, and by no means should she be thought of as only Olivier Assayas' wife. She is also, in her own right, one of the world's best filmmakers today. She's made 5 films. They are all, to some degree, of incredible, and only getting more so. Her latest will be out on December 2nd, I'm told. It's called Things to Come. It stars Isabelle Huppert. It is magnificent.
Dave?
Oh, okay. It's my turn to go. I felt very conflicted about this, and I had a bunch of choices, but I'm going to come down to somebody that, like, every single movie that I've saw, I found something to like in. And I'm consistently interested in new projects, even though I haven't been in maybe the past 3 years. It would be David Fincher.
Good choice.
Yeah.
Approved. Stamp.
What is the explanation?
I think he's a good pop visualist. I think in terms of when we see film history and we think about good things that came out of the music video to film era that we unfortunately or fortunately went through, the peak of that is going to be David Fincher, who managed to take what could have been like a really commercial, all flash, like crazy aesthetic and slowly apply his own discipline to a system that resisted him for a long time. But I think he sort of got his system down. He just needs to get more interesting projects in the pipeline, I think.
Batches, these are all good choices. Don't mess it up.
Oh, I just wanted to mention one David Fincher thing, which was I saw someone post a snippet of his commentary from Gone Girl. I have not listened to it, but he was just lashing out at people who complain about how many takes he does. And his quote was, "So everybody bitches and moans about how many takes I do. People I've never even met complain about how many takes I shoot. The take of Neil Patrick Harris parking that Jaguar dead center in the middle of that frame, that was take two. That was take two. It's in the movie. We walked away after take two. So please, go fuck yourselves."
The real question is does Ben Affleck have like a delightfully drunken Armageddon-esque voiceover on Gone Girl?
I will say that in person, David Fincher is one of the most intimidatingly intelligent people I've ever heard speak.
Did you ever watch the Social Network? Behind the scenes where him and Sorkin are in a room hammering out the script. Jesus, it's like watching two titans fight. It's terrifying. Anywho, I'm going to pick Ben Wheatley. This is probably not the right answer.
Oh, he was one of my runners up.
Great
job, Patches.
He's certainly, I just want to watch all of his movies. Yeah. I want to watch all of his experiments. And, I don't even adore High Rise. I saw it at midnight, totally half drunk and whacked out of my mind from not sleeping. It was so phantasmagoric, for lack of a better word.
Focused on exactly what it wanted to be.
Yeah, I think he cultures something out of each idea, and no movie is exactly the same, and yet they all definitely feel like Ben Wheatley. There's a stamp there.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I haven't completely put a finger on it, because he's a very exciting emerging voice. And
so you're excited for Free Fire?
I am. And I'm excited. I wouldn't normally be excited for a movie like that. So Free Fire is this movie that he made with Brie Larson. Has it played at festivals, David?
No. Have people seen this thing? Toronto. It's going to be at London.
Guys, it has Charlton
Copley. Room movie?
That's danger. That's a red alert.
Charlton Copley alert. That is my interest.
So I wouldn't normally be into a movie. It's set in the 70s. It's like a gritty crime film. Just wait. Sounds like genre aping, but I don't know.
Do we know if it's a one room movie? The previews make it look like it's a one room movie.
Oh, I haven't seen any footage of it. I just seen Brie Larson like laying on the ground with a pistol in her hand. That's
oh nice. So the previews make it look like a gun deal gone bad that all takes place in a single warehouse.
I believe that.
So
that also seems like him because a lot of his movies are staged in one location or around a central point, and I love that.
I'm here for Cillian Murphy's mustache.
I was not under the impression that.
I thought there was a chase involved with Free Fire.
Any footage?
I don't know.
All right.
Anyway, okay.
So those are, four white dudes? Yes?
Four Yay. White dudes sitting on a wall. Definitive picks.
Where are you seeing Free Fire footage?
In his imagination.
I saw a trailer for it.
Where? Comic-Con? No.
Probably before Swiss Army Man, if I'm going to guess. Last time I was not at like a Regal.
Wow. I've
seen a Free Fire trailer for sure because I was like, does this all take place at the Huya? And then the Ben Wheatley name came up and I'm like, in.
I do not think that trailer has made its way to the internet. But
oh, shit.
Scoop.
Well, exclusive.
You heard it here first.
Abigail, welcome to Zootopia.
All right, so for our third segment this evening, we are going to be talking about kids and shit. It's a good time to be a kid, unless, you know, you have to deal with living on this earth in the future, which is going to be tough. But in the here and now, when I say it's a good time to be a kid, I mean like the next few weeks. After that, you're on your own. But right now, we have some quality, or at least some interesting kids entertainment for the first time in a while. Some things that make it worth discussing in a broader context. This Friday, you have the release of Peach Dragon, which I can speak at least for Patches and myself. We're both big fans. Joanna and Dave, have you seen Peach Dragon?
No, I saw some.
I
saw some like extended D23 footage, but that was a long time ago. But I've heard that it is magical.
It's quite good.
And winsome.
Someone today was describing. The word that I went to when talking about it was sincerity, but someone, I think it was Bilga Beery, tweeted earlier today that it was a humble movie, and I thought that was really the really accurate choice of words for a movie that feels like a throwback, not only because it's set in a quaint small town, Pacific Northwest, actually shot in New Zealand in the 70s, but...
Are you sure it's the 70s? Because it seems kind of out of time. It seems kind of.
I do not believe that anyone says like, and now it's 1975.
Right.
But the vibe that I got was strong.
There are no
70s.
Cell phones. All the cars are old.
Are from the 70s. Huh.
It's interesting.
It's very like there's like a malt shop in town. Like it's very 70s. Like you know, malt shop goes back to an earlier age, but it does feel like it's certainly not the 50s or the 60s. So that's very good. And next week, a film, my lips are sealed. I'm under embargo until Friday, but there's a children's film coming out next Friday, and it is magnificent. If you're interested in all we're talking about, and we'll dance around it to the sounds of a shamisen.
There's really an embargo on this movie?
You can't
I don't mean to piss you off.
No, that's a marketing mistake.
I like it.
Be able to talk about
I like it.
Just to get the
I like it a lot.
Ground rule double on the inside baseball here. The embargo was originally scheduled for today. We're recording this on Monday the 8th. It was for reasons that are beyond me. Perhaps they didn't want to get lost in the shuffle. Perhaps
that's
they
probably
wanted to close the gap between. They didn't want to get lost in a Peach Dragon and all the hubbub. The embargo is now on Friday night. Friday night. At 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Wow, did I love whatever the fuck that is. But
let's just say if it was like The Box Trolls, if it was like Coraline, I could imagine it getting lost in the shuffle as those films have. They're gems, but this is something entirely different. But
entirely
if it was like
different.
That, like
it's a completely
like
different movie, for sure. And also opening this week is another animated film, which is less geared towards children. Called Sausage Party.
Oh my god, which is the worst movie I've ever seen in my entire life.
I have heard nothing but good things about it, except from Joanna.
It's not good. I stand with her. I'm with her.
So hashtag I'm with her. It's so bad.
That's the hashtag for this podcast.
I was immensely put off by the trailers, but many people seem to like this movie.
No, you're crazy. Like, there were people at South by, I saw South by Southwest. There were people at South by who liked it. There were a lot of people in that audience who hated it.
I remember that being the case. It seems like the tide has turned to the positive, but it is my solemn duty to see it and file a full length review this week. So
the smart film writers that I sat in the back of the theater with. Who work for a number of different outlets. We all just...
How smart could they have been if they decided to be film writers?
We all walked out onto the Austin streets and talked about how it was the worst thing we had ever seen. So bad. I don't even understand how it exists.
This is off topic because although it is animated, it is clearly not for kids. But we come off a summer where, as per usual, a lot of the entertainment that was geared for kids was... either just insultingly derivative, as was the case with The Secret Life of Pets, which was a huge success commercially. It was a sequel to a long-running franchise. It was just something to babysit the kids in the case of Ice Age 5. 4, 5, who cares?
I will say that I saw Ice Age 4 in theaters, and there is a mythology to follow. So this isn't just for, this is for
I really
at
loved,
least 10-year-olds who are really invested in mythos.
Don't let this undermine my Sausage Party opinion, but I really loved the BFG. So
there was the BFG. Thank you for bringing that up. There was the BFG, which was definitely, a lot more child friendly than some other Roald Dahl adaptations.
And the F stood for fart.
The F stood for fart. Certainly more so than even Spielberg had made in the past, which is saying something because he, made his bones on films like E.T. and then more recently The Adventures of Tintin, Saving Private Ryan, of course, very children's classic.
Mean, kids love that movie.
Yeah. So, and we also, thanks to a company like G-Kids, which has really been pushing, getting a lot of international animated fare into American theaters and to American VOD, and it's ironic that I bring them up in this context, because so much of what G-Kids, despite the name of their company, has done is to import these films that disprove the uniquely American understanding of animation being only for kids. I think their name gets in the way of that, and obviously kid-friendly animations... tend to be their bread and butter, but they have only compounded the sense that there are options out there for kids that they don't just have to wait for Frozen 2 or Moana.
Did you see the G Kids film Phantom Boy?
I did not, but I heard pretty good things. Did you see it?
Yes, I did. It's a whimsical little movie about a phantom boy. who assists in solving a mystery, which is really cute. And G-Kids has put out some great movies this year.
Extraordinary World, and they have Miss Hokusai, which I have seen and is beautiful and is a little bit more adult skewing. It's a history lesson about a famous Japanese calligrapher.
They also put out April in the Extraordinary World, which it's a pretty good... I'm not a big steampunk fan, but... For like Franco-Prussian war set steampunk about a young girl, saving her family or what does she do? She comes up with a secret in
she wears goggles.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful.
It's extraordinary, or the world is extraordinary, one way or the other. But we, I feel, whenever the subject of kids' movies comes up and we relate them to our own views as movie-going kids, I think the general sentiment seems to be that kids these days don't really have the same fortune that we do. And that may still be the case, but it does seem, especially given how often these kids are going to the movies, it's just not very, that at least if spaced out every few weeks, there is something for them to see that isn't just garbage. And in August, it seems like the percentage is skewing even more in their favor. So I just want to open the floor and talk about kids, the state of movies that are aimed at children.
You guys liked Zootopia, right? I haven't met a...
No!
I really liked it. Yeah.
Okay, so I've met one solitary person who didn't like Zootopia, and that's David Ehrlich. Everyone of all sizes loved Zootopia.
Well, funnily enough, a guy named Scott Renshaw, who is friend of mine. It's a critic.
Doesn't exist. Not a real person.
Doesn't exist. I've met him. He does exist. He is the only other person I know off the top of my head who really did not like Zootopia. And he is also obsessed with the movie We Cannot Name that is coming out next week.
Wait, so. Didn't he write a letter to a child about why he can hate Zootopia or something? Or why they can love it and he can hate it? I don't know. It was really
That doesn't seem like Scott Renshaw's
style. The definition. I want to say something about the definition of movies for children, just because I had like a really interesting recent example. My goddaughter is, God, I'm going to get it wrong. I think she's 4. And she's seen like Jurassic Park, which is, she's way too young for that. Her favorite movie is Princess Mononoke, blah, blah, blah. And then my nephew, who's 5, has seen like 3-4 movies ever, and we tried to show him the Disney Robin Hood over the weekend, and it was too scary for him. And he made a switch to The Sound of Music. And so it's really interesting, like, the varying levels of tolerance. Like, I was thinking, like, he would never be able to get through Zootopia, you know, and like, Peace Dragon would probably terrify him. Like, it's so interesting. I guess this is a nonsense anecdote about like the way kids are raised and what their tolerance for
They're
scary
weak.
Is. Well, no, just like what constitutes a kid's movie varies by from kid to kid, man.
As a brief aside, Scott Renshaw did in fact he received a letter to the City Weekly where he works in Utah by 6-year-old twins asking him to change his rating, and he wrote back, "Fuck you." No.
They were weak.
He wrote back a thoughtful response, which I think was more intended for adults who were, and we've seen certainly that adults or people purporting to be adults are a lot more.
It was a letter to children for adults. It was a DreamWorks
movie. By reviews.
Movie.
Exactly. No, it was a Pixar movie. Are a lot more incensed by reviews that go against the grain of what they believe to be true, but that is, you can look this up. There's an article on IndieWire.com.
Wait, so all of us, of all of us here, though, right? The biggest, perhaps, animation expert is Dave, and so I'm wondering.
Sure, yeah.
I'm wondering.
Are we talking specifically about animated children's movies or like children's cinema?
Well, children's cinema that's not animated barely exists at this point.
I mean, that's not true. You have like Tales of Middle School everythings that like come out every other year that do well enough to,
I mean, Diary of a Wimpy Kid is one of the only franchises that exists for the younger age kids, and actually the first one is very good.
Franchises, but I mean, like, it's only because Buena Vista has, you know, refocused towards like feel good, you know, adult movies, where every once in a while, like back when we were children, they were, you know, giving us our, you know, live action movies for families. But I think definitely now, I mean, definitely this year, if it's not a superhero movie, if it's not a talking animal, it's not making any money. So I don't know. I've been looking a lot into what current day kids of certain age groups have in terms of access to variety. Because on one hand, if you are a media sensitive parent or a media sensitive family, you have access to absolutely anything you want. You want to find like the weird Looney Tunes episode that I had to like wait till it came on like the next Thursday night, you know, whatever, you could probably pull that up on YouTube. But I don't think I think there are a lot of people like me who are establishing what it means for these properties to exist and be like good or functional or whatnot. So there's something like Adventure Time, which I feel is great for kids. It's very stylistic, but it's designed to be a show about sort of like nostalgic feelings old school role playing elements that would speak to adults while telling, you know, shorter 11-minute stories for kids. I don't know how many kids were into the fact that the like 5th season of Adventure Time had like over 40 episodes, but the adults absolutely loved it because it like built this long form storytelling thing. The thing is that the shit that we watched when we were little weren't what we would define as necessarily successful now. They were like pioneering. You know, your Mr. Rogers Neighborhood isn't the best produced thing, and your, you know, cartoons in the 80s are all about selling toys. They're not about making animation or selling cartoons. But then through investigation through that, you know, you find, you know, anime or whatnot, and then we have an entire generation that tries to make a whitewashed live action Akira. So I think that we're like fine in terms of children's entertainment. I'm just interested because there's nothing besides like talking animals, which we always know that has worked, that is like shown through in a franchising way really reliably like it did for our generation. So like, you know, we could have like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles kids or Ghostbusters kids, or, you know, we even like, I don't know, there's a period in my life where it mattered what kind of like jeans you bought or whatnot, but like making these little circles of acceptance for ourselves, it seems like all these tentpole movies that are meant to be family movies are all big tent movies. So I don't know where the,
what about,
you know, good entertainment for kids, it's niche.
What about, does Star Wars count, like Star Wars, the animated series, do those count as talking animals because they're like talking aliens, or...
No, but they're also not for kids. I mean, kids will watch them with parents, but I really, even though they're on Disney XD, the amount of coverage like IO9 will give them means they're not for kids.
But and they that's are the real for thing kids. I mean, kid. Like adults, you know, Star Wars Nostalgia Factory is always going to sucker in the adults, but like those shows, like, you know, my best friend's a second grade teacher, and all of her kids watched the Star Wars animated series, like, you know, not because they were dragged by their parents, but because they loved it, and that's what Star Wars was to them, you know. Sure, it, just because adults watch it doesn't mean it's not for kids, you know.
There are more shows out there beyond Star Wars that we're not talking about that kids are obsessed with, you know. I'm thinking like the Phineas and Ferbs of the world. I'm not even sure if Phineas and the Ferb is on anymore, and I'm Clue. Glad I don't, because kids can have that one, you know. There's a lot of shows on Disney XD, Nickelodeon, you know, ABC Family or whatever,
the whole My Little Pony craze.
Yes, like there's just so much out there for kids that we don't know about, and we shouldn't, and that makes me feel good. And we're not parents, so none of us are really truly able to comment on this. We can only comment on the movies, because we basically see everything that comes out. We wonder, I think it gets under our skin that there's not something that feels acceptable on like an intelligence level for kids very often. And we see a movie like Pete's Dragon that, I mean, I've already been hearing murmurs from people being like, it's kind of boring, or like, kids will never be into this. Oh, and I'm not sure why we draw that line in the sand so quickly. There were kids in my theater today. They weren't like laughing their asses off, or they weren't bawling either when it got scary. They were just kind of sitting there enthralled by the story. And this is exactly what we want. And it's, they're few and far between, because they were few and far between even in the 90s. I'm trying to think of like, when we talk about, oh, the movies that we got, Dave, you mentioned that. Like, what are you even thinking of? You know, The Mighty Ducks? Is that what you're... What movies are you talking about?
I mean, yeah, there was like old children's sports movies, obviously. We had a whole bunch of, like, I feel like school movies. Like, I think David talked about the other darker Roald Dahl applications. But, like, a lot of our stuff was also darker. So, like, I remember, like, I don't know how Ace Ventura Pet Detective played when it was released in your town, but in my town it was like majority 10-year-old boys.
That is not a kids movie, though.
I was like, it's not a kids movie.
I know, but that
I think.
Well, no, but that's what I'm saying. Is like, what we consider kids movies now are not going to be the kids movies. They're the buckshot that's going to hit families. That's going to hit everybody.
Well,
I'm more curious about like what kids are like pulling things out. Like, I'm pretty sure nobody is like getting psyched about Stranger Things, but I found that like in 99, when you know, a whole new generation of Star Wars fans came along, I completely did not see them coming and like embracing the prequel trilogy as they did. And so we sort of,
but the reason
like,
they
lived with the dual fandom,
the reason they did is because it starred a kid. And I think that's what a lot of movies miss these days. They're not starring someone that looks like the kids watching them, who can really walk them through this story, become the proxy.
Isn't that what Disney is trying so hard to do, like with Neil Sethi and Jungle Book, and with his kid in Pete's Dragon, and like the young undiscovered woman that they've got playing the lead in Moana? Like, they're really going after these like not unctuous kid actors, but these sort of undiscovered, more naturalistic kids, which I think is a really, really smart, cool move on their,
yeah,
on their part.
You mentioned Stranger Things. We've talked about it on the show before. You can go listen to that. But the difference with Stranger Things, so many movies are just putting the adults in kid roles. They're either precocious or they have all these hobbies or interests that are exactly like the adults that will be watching them, gorging them. Actually, Pete's Dragon has one moment where I was kind of like, come on, because I didn't realize it was set in the 1970s until a little while into the movie. That's how, you know, it's never stated. But the little girl, one of the little girls of the movie, is like, teaches him how to use a record player. And I'm like, Jesus, come on, no one's listening to a record right now. But then I realized it was the 1970s, so
that's different than, like,
hipsters.
That feels okay. That's like exploration and weirdness. It's not that,
sure.
You know, what was the movie where Keira Knightley taught Steve Carell, like lectured Steve Carell on records?
End of the World, whatever that movie's
called. Yeah, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World or whatever.
Egregious.
I mean, I'm more curious about, we've definitely got the family market, or at least somebody's figured that out by evidence of, like, I'm pretty sure we talked about when this podcast was called Op Kino. How weird it was that Ice Age was still around, considering, like, there are no adults that watch that franchise. That franchise is completely... I haven't met a single adult that's been like, I want to see the Ice Age
franchise. That franchise is made for iPads and, like, long car rides, I think. Parents out there can tell me I'm wrong, but I think a lot of cartoon entertainment, especially, I was knocking Angry Birds a little bit months ago for being a movie that looked shot entirely in medium close-ups, singles, cutting back and forth. I'm like, this is really made for an iPad and to kind of just, you know, numb children into falling asleep on long car rides.
Well, I mean, I guess, but that's just Saturday morning cartoons on 4:3 television when color was coming along.
It is.
Like, that's where the stuff comes out of.
But that's not necessarily, if you want big screen entertainment, if you want something that kids can truly enjoy and not just watch or sit through, then it's something different. You know, we on Thrillist, we just ran this piece by an author who loved Matilda. Meant a lot to him, that 96 Roald Dahl adaptation by Danny DeVito. And he talked to Mara Wilson, a lot of people involved with the movie. And you just get a sense that they were making, you know, the whole conversation was, is it too dark or is it too, the whole reason it had to be a little dark was to be so optimistic and really empower Matilda about reading and being independent and characterizing her in a real way, making Matilda more than the hero of a wacky adventure or more than the proxy for adults who would also check out Matilda.
I love Roald Dahl for that. I love Roald Dahl for having real threats in his stories. I remember my third grade teachers reading us Matilda and the Witches and James the Giant Peach and BFG. And, like, it's legitimately scary. I think the Steven Spielberg BFG has legitimately scary, threatening giants. Like, and I think that makes for great kids storytelling. My nephew would never be able to watch it, but I think that it should have some scary bits in it. It really should. Did we lose David? Like, did he set us on this path and then just wander away?
He gets bored really easy.
Okay.
I mean, just to...
Oh, no. I mean, I think that it may seem in this summer of, like, horrible, dire movies that we're running down, like, a horrible path. But if you think about what we've lived through in terms of what we'd consider family entertainment for, like, our age, we were, you know, really beneficial to get, like, a Disney animation resurgence and, like, right at the tail end, some pretty good Harry Potter books. And I'm sure that, like, the generation, like, right below us benefited, like, hell from Pixar resurging when it did. And there's going to be something that we see as the pattern for this group of kids. I'm just not sure we could see it yet outside of talking animals are back.
Yeah, I'm discouraged, actually, when we so often kind of discredit the phrase kids movie as if that's a bad thing. No, kids, it's not kids movies, they're just movies, and some of them have
anybody
kids in it.
Anybody
who
credits kids movies for just being kids movies has not seen Hotel for Dogs and let that movie seep into the center of the
A classic of canine cinema. Caninema? But yeah, I just, you know, I see a movie like, I've got really frustrated for Batman Superman and feeling like there wasn't superhero movies for kids, and this is opening a can of worms. I really don't think the Marvel movies are either for
because they don't speak to children. You know, give me Zoom again, or give me whatever that Shazam. Kurt Russell Academy movie was. But like, and then you have Lego Batman, and that's still not for kids. I'm watching these trailers, and it's all for adults. Now I get it. Get the adults buying the tickets in the theater, and then you can be wacky and have a kids movie. But it's still like, if that exists, if that's part of the substance, then it's not speaking to kids. You're not, this Batman is making lots of references to stuff that is beyond children, and it's just going to be wacky and colorful for kids, and that's not for kids.
Right. It's the tough thing, because I've only talked to a few children's authors in my life, but the one thing that's been consistent across all of them is they warn you against speaking down to children. So you're going to get a whole bunch of movies of what people think kids are like ready for. But like Joanna's relations, they have to just like make that choice on their own, because sometimes it's just Sound of Music is the best way to go.
Yeah, so I guess this was a walk around recommendation for Pete's Dragon, which we, you know, David and I mentioned we really like. But there are kind of saviors of kids cinema out there. I think Goosebumps, which is on Netflix right now, is a pretty good kids movie, and
it was a perfect. What, didn't we call it like the perfect? Not we. Didn't you call it like the perfect sleepover movie? I think that's what a lot of people thought about Goosebumps. I watched it. I didn't love it, but like I could see why it's not for me and who it's for. You know.
When Dave slept over my house, we had a great time.
Yeah,
it was sweet. We made popcorn.
I just still think, you know, I'm never inclined to get super enthusiastic about something that's so popular, because, you know, you want to have like the cooler, edgier, Leica-y recommendation. But Zootopia, man, that movie, that's a good movie.
It's a damn good movie.
Yeah,
and I'm glad I can say it in the, without being shouted
and
over
class.
That it's terrible.
And crack.
Kids movies. So, to really wrap this up, we should say to everyone listening, if you have kids, you should especially chime in here and tell us what you're raising them on, so that we can, you know, vet you for the future if your kids are in good
well, I mean,
hands.
So some that kids... we know, and we'll hook your kids as podcast listeners.
Well, a father of I think she's 8, father of an 8-year-old I know, she doesn't like to watch, she used to be really into like animated shows and stuff like that. Now she likes watching people play Minecraft on YouTube. So that might be the
right.
future of kids' movies and TV,
Jesus.
Right?
Well, that's a downer.
I know. I just thought I'd...
They could watch Crank. That's like the same
make
thing.
Make us all sad. All right.
All right. Kids. It came out in 1995. See it. I messed up tonight. I lost another... And that does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back... I don't know. I'm not. I need to communicate with David, who we lost at the end of this segment 3, if that wasn't clear, due to technical difficulties.
Somebody's monkey's paw just went one finger down out there listening.
Oh my God.
Wow. Dark. David disappeared. And so I'm not sure we'll be back with a full review of Pete's Dragon, or definitely probably not Sausage Party, which Joanna and I will give you the skinny. It's just not.
It's the worst. It's the worst.
It's like, you know what? There's a big orgy at some point. That was funny. Spoilers. Anyway, so I'm not sure when we'll be back, but we'll definitely be back next week. There's a storm of spoilers coming this week. Am I right?
Yeah, we're talking Suicide Squad and The Killing
Joke.
We're gonna
drag some shit.
We are about to drag all the shit.
The Joker has the same laugh as my really elderly grandmother. Why don't we tell the people where they can find us on the internet? Dave?
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can spell my first name, DA70. That's also my Twitter handle. I blog at geek.com, and I podcast at fightinginthewarroom.com, where you could find all our glorious podcasts, and then also they all push into the main feed. You could also comment. You can find back episodes. I extended, so I think we have our full 270-something back catalog now. You could totally find all that, fightinginthewarroom.com. And David Ehrlich, who can be found on Twitter, at David Ehrlich, can also tell you on all our back episodes. You can find us on Facebook, Facebook.com/fightinginthewarroom.
I'm Joanna Robinson. You can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. And like I said before, we will be dragging some shit, or as Dave said, we'll be dragging some shit on Storm of Spoilers this week.
And I'm Slipknot, and I'm dead. Oh. Oh.
Justice for Adam Beach.
You were also a serial rapist in the earlier.
Oh my god. I'm not Slipknot. I'm not Slipknot. I'm Matt Patches, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And I'm the senior entertainment editor for Thrillist, which you can go read at Thrillist.com. And we are on Twitter at FITWR. And there you can answer this week's lightning round question, which is...
In honor of Hell or High Water, what is the best Jeff Bridges performance?
And we will be retweeting a bunch of those. Please include explanation. That's much more fun. And we'll be talking to you soon. Bye.